This is an ABC podcast.
DJ Aristotle's done it again. He's finally, not finally, he's once more managed to conscript Bob Dylan into the show. That's like a Rolling Stone, Bob Dylan. Probably the favourite artist of my co-host, Scott Stevens. Well, Ed Ali's my name. Welcome to The Minefield. We're trying to negotiate the ethical and moral dilemmas of modern life. I began a sentence I was confident with, Scott, until I started saying it. Then I wondered if I should be so confident.
There is no excuse that I need to be given for incorporating a Leonard Cohen or a Bob Dylan. If this were a different sort of show, we could talk about Friedrich Chopin's four ballads. We could talk Are you kidding me?
No.
That's a bet.
I'm a Scriabin man myself.
Are you truly?
I quite like Scriabin, yeah. He was just nuts. I think that's what you want in a composer.
Dylan is very important for me, though. And look, thank you for indulging me. Because, I mean, there is something. Precisely because he, unlike modern celebrities, refuses any attempt, militantly refuses, in fact, any attempt to peer beyond the surface, to get to any deeper authenticity. There is no deeper authenticity to Bob Dylan. In the same way, I suspect you would argue, there's no deeper authenticity to Freddie Mercury. So what that means is there is a kind of moral philosophical quality to Bob Dylan's lyrics of the same caliber and quality, I suspect, to some of, especially Leonard Cohen's later writing, that just makes it perfect for this show. Why do you need, and when we're talking about the topic that we're talking about today, how could you not do Like a Rolling Stone, which I think is the perfect aesthetic diagnosis of precisely the problem that we're tackling for this episode?
Okay. Do you want to explain?
I would. We promised, and this is one of those promises that we're actually going to keep this year.
I like that we call it a promise when we're doing it, because then it sounds like we've kept a promise. Right. When we're not doing it, it was like, oh, it was an idea.
Anyway, we said that each month we were going to devote one episode to call
it
what you will.
Well, we didn't say each month, did we?
We did.
Be very careful what you promised.
We did. No, we okay. We will, because I think it's an important enough series we really should keep reminding ourselves we need to do one each month. And I think we really, really, really should. So call it what you like. If you want to think about this series in a more theological register, maybe you could call them cardinal sins or deadly sins. If you want to think about this in a more recognizable moral register that, say, stems from Montaigne instead of Immanuel Kant or instead of Thomas Aquinas, maybe we could call it ordinary vices. Certain habits, dispositions, attitudes, characteristics, ways of patterns of life that we get up to that are peculiarly corrosive, not just to the soul, but also to our relationships with others within a common civil or moral or political community. But I think what also makes these deadly sins or these ordinary vices so corrosive is that in a very real way, in our time, we've become peculiarly inured to them. We don't maybe see them as vicious as they in fact are. The one that we're doing today, I think really, it's probably the most complex of all of them. And it's complex because for Immanuel Kant and for Thomas Aquinas, so in both the moral and the theological registers, this vice or this characteristic or disposition or attitude is the worst of them all. And this is pride. So Thomas Aquinas, for instance, following St. Augustine before him, said that pride was in fact the original sin in the garden, this elevating of the human self above the command of its creator, this proud self-conceit that then reached out and took what it was not entitled to, that is in fact the original sin. For Immanuel Kant, I think in a very different, but also I think in a fairly important way, pride is a peculiar affront or a peculiar offense to the obligation to treat others with dignity, with a capital D, with respect, with capital R, to give them what is in fact owed to them. So in both sort of moral and theological registers, there is something peculiarly wrong with pride. Let me just put this question though to you, Waleed. In both instances, isn't it the case that pride only becomes vicious when it is counterposed when it's put up against a big theological or big moral claim, capital D dignity or capital G God. As soon as you no longer have that big countervailing claim, this thing that owes, that is owed your obligation, that is owed your fealty, pride, I wondered, no longer is quite as problematic as it was before. Is that an interesting way of kicking off the discussion?
Yeah, but you've taken my point.
Oh, right.
I don't know what to do. I think you're right. And I think this is clearest, I think, in the theological case, because the very essence of pride is that it's making a god of oneself, right? It's failing to recognize one's position in the cosmos in relation to that which is supreme, right? So, yes. But I also think in some ways that needs to be teased out a touch, because I wonder if pride, the English word pride, is a bit flat and captures a bit much. So, for example, so I'm doing this only because I'm a tiny bit familiar with it from the Islamic context, but there is a difference in Arabic between izza, which is often translated as pride, and kibr, which is also translated as pride. And izza is really this notion, it's coupled with notions of honor and power and dignity, in a sense, but it is to do with the way in which you comport yourself, the way in which you, do you behave with honor? Are you a people of honor, etc.? Kibr is more, even though izza is sometimes used in this way as well, but kibr is more to do with arrogance and conceit and this idea of superiority or condescension towards another. And I don't know that that nuance is captured when we talk about pride in English. It might be within the Christian tradition. I don't know. You'd be better placed than me to answer that question. But I think it's a really important distinction, because I think it's very easy. I think two things follow from what you said. One is that in the absence of something greater than oneself, pride ceases to be a problem, right? Why wouldn't you be proud? But also that to say pride is a problem can very quickly lead, in certain cultural imaginations anyway, to a sense of uselessness, a kind of sense that one is, uselessness is not the right word, worthlessness, such that you become almost, in a perverse way, freed of any obligations, because who are you anyway? I think it's a really important distinction to try to hold together. And maybe that's why we see what we see. You know, it's in our current age, where there are no superior beings, you could argue, particularly as things become more and more individualistic, nothing becomes superior to the individual. And so you get this thing, don't you? You get people thinking they're worthless, and you get people being incredibly arrogant. And I'm aware that those things have always existed as long as human beings have, but they do seem amplified at the moment. And I wonder if what you've identified about the absence of anything greater than oneself is really the root of that phenomenon.
Can I pick up? I'm really glad you've taken it in this direction. Can I just stick with the notion of honor? Because I think there is something kind of important here that we really need to identify. Again, I'm probably more familiar with this in sort of the Latin and Greco-Roman culture than I am within Arabic culture. But honor within the Greco-Roman political and social milieu, it's not just comportment. It's not just the way in which one bears oneself or the dignified way in which one carries oneself or behaves towards others. But honor cannot be gained by oneself. I can't reach out and grab honor. Honor has to be conferred by others, which means that honor is also something that can be taken away when I behave in a manner that is disrespectful or dishonorable. So I assume within Arabic culture as well, that notion of honor which is accorded and honor which is taken away, that's also operative within.
Yeah, because the notion of respect is kind of bound up.
That's right.
You touched, I think you gave it a capital R, so you definitely mentioned it. Yeah, I think that's true. But at the same time, and now I'm kind of, this is very much, I could be wrong about this, but at the same time, I think that it's something that you can lose through your conduct, perhaps even irrespective of whether or not
in your own eyes, you can become dishonorable in your own eyes.
Or perhaps in God's eyes, in which case you still then, you need something to refer to, don't you? You need some greater thing to refer to, because there is this notion of those who are held in esteem in the eyes of human beings, but not in the eyes of God, and the reverse being true.
let me give this a little Kantian inflection, just to sort of fill out the idea of pride, because I don't think I want to move beyond the idea of pride too much. I think this idea of self-esteem and of honorability, or of almost a kind of self-respect, I think that all these things are germane. I think all these things are important and internal to the notion of pride. But I think in the way that Immanuel Kant teases out two of the perversions of pride, I think it's really, really helpful here. He has, on the one hand, this idea of pride or arrogantia, of a kind of self-conceit. So this is a refusal to be modest in the way that I demand respect of others. So it is the natural form in some way. Kant's been very Aristotelian here. It's a natural form of the longing, the desire for honor, of self-respect, of people to regard me well. But it's a kind of immodesty about it. So I demand it from others, but that direction is only ever one way. I want people to be preoccupied, if you like, in the way that they think about me, in the proper accordance of respect that they show me. But then there's that other Kantian idea that is more pervasive. I think it's particularly pervasive in our time. And that's the idea of pride as superbia, as a kind of, as a vaunting of oneself and an arrogance that demands what I refuse to accord others. So I demand respect, but I refuse to give that respect in turn. This, if you like, is the pride of the one-way mirror. I want to be gazed at, but I don't want to see others, if you like, with the eyes of grace, as Iris Murdoch would put it. And that, I think, is where we have Bob Dylan. That's like a Rolling Stone. This kind of wonderful, wonderful moment where, you know, you threw the bums a dime in your prime. You didn't turn around and see the frowns on of the jokers and the clowns as they all did their tricks for you. This kind of wanting to be performed for, wanting to be admired, even as you're giving charity, but not wanting to see the people who are admiring you. So I think that's where, so pride, in order to be proud in the Kantian register, is to be characterized by a degree of immunity from the countervailing moral demands of others. And I think that's something I don't think I want to trade away too quickly.
No, I think that's really important, because that's really the thing that opens the door to all kinds of vast oppressions. This is The Minefield. You can listen to the show on the radio on RN. You might be doing that right now. Thank you very much for doing so. But you can also listen to us anytime you like on the ABC Listen app. The show also exists as a podcast, which has extra content, because we keep banging on after the final siren has gone off. Teaser reference Scott won't understand. So you can subscribe to our podcast wherever it is that you do such things. Scott, we have a guest. She's been waiting very patiently while we've been banging onto ourselves, and I'm waiting to be scattered by her insights. Are you ready?
Yes, indeed. Susie Kilmister is lecturer in philosophy at Monash University. She's the author of a forthcoming book called The Contours of Dignity. Susie, thank you so much for joining us on The Minefield.
Thanks for having me.
So let's begin. Since so much of your recent work has been, or not just recent work, dear God, for the last decade you've been thinking and writing and working very productively on the topic of dignity, let's begin with, I think, capital P pride, but without the negative connotations. So, I mean, Waleed made reference to this before. We know, don't we, what it looks like when an oppressed people, or an oppressed class, or an oppressed gender is left almost entirely without a sense of pride, without the necessary degree of self-esteem that's required to hold oneself to a particular moral standard, or even simply to offer others a kind of countervailing defiance in the face of their illicit forms of pride. Is it proper? Is it right to think about pride solely in a kind of negative register, or is pride the precondition to the realization of personal dignity?
So I think there's definitely positive elements to pride, though, as you've noted, it can go in very bad directions, particularly if we're thinking about political communities and the ways in which pride can get tied up in oppression. But I think if we think about pride in terms of something like self-esteem or self-respect, the way in which we evaluate ourselves, then some degree of pride, I think, is incredibly important, and particularly important for people who have certain kinds of social identities that are perhaps denigrated within their political community, where a kind of sense of self-esteem might take a bit of a battering, I guess, in the public domain. That to find things that we can take pride in, I think, is either individually or collectively, can be incredibly important for well-being. So that idea of proving one's worth or showing one's worth or standing up for one's worth, I think is an element of pride that can be incredibly beneficial. The difficulty, of course, is when people who already have a fair amount of social power, already are held in high esteem, hold on to, in a sense, that position and take themselves to be worthy of that position. And that kind of form of pride, I think, can actually end up exacerbating inequalities rather than kind of countering them. So I think the kind of social position is really important. Pride is a useful corrective, I think, for people who are held in a kind of lower position in society, but exacerbates inequality when it's being enacted by people in the higher positions of power.
Can I just take, I'm so sorry, Willie, you're going to like this, so I'm not going to apologize too much. Can I just say, though, a moral gesture that I suspect Kant would have found morally objectionable, but is for me the quintessential demonstration of a kind of countervailing or transitional pride, would be Muhammad Ali's, I mean, really immodest, let's call it straight, immodest displays of contempt for his opponents, of pride for those who have fallen at his feet. And yet there was something about that that wasn't vicious, was it? There's a countervailing character to this, but also there's a representative character. There's a demonstration that the pride, the illicit forms of cultural, political, class pride to which we have been subject and to which we have been enslaved is something I no longer regard. I no longer take it seriously. I am no longer affected by it. And here's my demonstration that I am now immune to your displays of pride. There is something about that that's virtuous, is there not?
I think there probably is. But I think one thing to bear in mind with the Muhammad Ali example is, in a sense, what the pride is directed at. So there's the, I guess, content of the pride and also the display or exhibition of the pride. And these, I think, can both be really important in thinking about when pride can be morally beneficial or when it can be damaging. So in terms of thinking about what it is that Muhammad Ali is expressing pride about, the philosopher Stephen Darwell draws this really useful distinction between what he calls appraisal respect and recognition respect. And if we think about pride as being tied up in respect, this can be a really useful way to think about it, where appraisal respect is a kind of evaluation of ourselves, if it's directed at ourselves, of how good we are according to some kind of metric. So we might have appraisal respect for ourselves as a tennis player or a boxer or a gardener or a philosopher or whatever it is. And it's just a kind of evaluation of how good we are in that dimension. Whereas recognition respect is about treating something in accordance with the kind of thing that it is. So we offer, say, recognition respect to a judge by standing when they walk into a room. It's a kind of demonstration that we acknowledge their position and how they ought to be treated accordingly. Now, if we kind of put that into the register of pride, I think we could see what Muhammad Ali was doing as instantiating quite a high level of appraisal respect for his boxing abilities. And I think if we're thinking about pride in our abilities to do a certain kind of thing, there's nothing particularly problematic about that. It can be an incredibly good motivator to recognize that we're good at something, to strive to be good at something, to take pride in it when we have done well. If we think about the phrase to take pride in one's work, it's really important to have that as a kind of motivator and to try to achieve that. But there's a real difference between that and thinking that we as a kind of person ought to be treated in a different kind of way to others, which comes back to something you said before about the kind of asymmetry of pride being a problem. If I think I ought to be treated in respect, but I don't want to issue that kind of respect to someone else. So I think there's a real difference between saying I'm really good at this, then we might think about how that's expressed and whether certain expressions of that might be problematic. I think there's other kind of sports people we might look at and think, it's fair enough to say you're very good at this, but maybe the way you're expressing that is a little problematic. A little humility would be called for. But that's very different from saying, I deserve to be treated in this certain kind of way, but other people don't.
But in the example of Muhammad Ali, or even I'd say Adam Goods, right, Waleed, I mean, what's going on there isn't just self-appraisal, but there's also a demand, a command for recognition, respect, in the same way that a judge might order someone to stand up. When somebody walks in the room, there is a moral claim. You will respect me, by God, which isn't purely narcissistic, I don't think. There's something else
going on. Because they're depersonalized.
That's what's happening there, right?
So the judge example is a really interesting one to think about. Because, of course, in most places, in sort of the common law tradition, judges wear wigs and robes, and there are exceptions to that. But there's kind of a rationale for that, which is to do with the invisibility of the person, right? That it becomes the embodiment of the, it's not the judge that you're standing up for, the person of the judge, it's the office of the judge, the institution of the law, it's that sort of thing. The Adam Goods thing, I think, is similar. Adam Goods is not standing up demanding respect for himself in
or
his
not
capacity.
Just, not just himself, perhaps.
I would say not for himself at all.
Oh, as wow.
Well, maybe we're saying the same thing with different words, but I don't think he's saying, I'm Adam Goods and you'd better respect that. I think what he's saying is, anyone in my position, like I represent a kind of idea of people, certain people, certain positions, and that's what should be accorded respect, and it shouldn't be denied to someone just because they happen to be me.
I think that sounds really similar. I was thinking when we were talking about the Adam Goods example and why I was saying it's not just about the role, that it might be something individual, but I think I do agree with you. I was thinking about the civil rights demonstrations in the US where the people were wearing the billboard saying, I am a man, right? There's something personal about that. It is about me standing here in front of you, but it's also about, I think, this symmetry, right? It's I also am a man or a woman, I suppose, yeah. And therefore demand respect, not because of the particular individual that I am, but just because everyone deserves to be treated in a certain
I'm here
kind of
not
way.
In my capacity as me, but in my capacity as an instantiation of a whole lot of other... Yeah, but here's the... where you draw this distinction between the pride of the dominant and the pride of the oppressed, shall we say, there is a real danger there, isn't there?
Brilliant.
Because there comes a point at which, unless you really identify what's different, so that these are actually different concepts, I think there's a real risk in making a virtue of a vice simply because of one's social positioning, right? Which is, I think, how you end up observing things like the oppressor-oppressed cycle, right? Those who are oppressed take on what would be a vice in the hands of the oppressor, and then eventually they might rise, but now they've embodied that vice, which we were prepared to overlook or perhaps even laud in their subservient position, and now they'll start the next cycle of oppression. In other words, there have to be certain kind of moral categories that apply irrespective of social positioning and can't merely be the whim of power relations or political positioning.
Yeah, I think if we think of what we might call appropriate pride as a demand to be treated as an equal, this might get around some of that, right? So if the idea is that what, in order to have an appropriate level of self-respect, in order to be able to look each other in the eye in a political and social community, we need to be accorded certain amounts of respect, then that demand to be treated as an equal, I think, is an appropriate response to oppression. And it might look an awful lot like pride, maybe that's one way of putting it. It will be making the same kind of claims that someone who's in a position of power might make, using the same words, the same kind of gestures. But because it's a demand to be kind of lifted up to the position of equal, that's what makes it a virtue, not a vice. Whereas if someone's already in a position of authority, their exhibitions of pride, in some sense, can't be claims to be treated as an equal.
But what if it's a claim to dismiss you as you dismiss me?
I guess if it's in the process of trying to be seen as an equal, we might think of it as taking someone else down a peg, right? If we think of that as what Muhammad Ali was doing, if we take his the attitude that he was displaying as not just a kind of I'm good at boxing, but as a broader social commentary, that attempt to in some sense downplay someone else's standing in order to level the playing field. I might be a little more open to the idea that that could be...
I know you're more open to it. My question is that not a very dangerous...
I think it is dangerous. It can be dangerous. Because I think we're not very good... People in general aren't very good judges of when we're in fact being treated as equals. So when you were talking about the oppressor-oppressed cycle, I think there's this related problem of people becoming blind to their own privilege. And so if they start to be treated differently, experiencing this... sincerely experiencing this as a kind of put down and as being treated as lesser. And so, yes, if we get these kind of public habits of certain people saying and doing certain things and then we say, well, that's okay, and other people experience themselves as being denigrated and so want to react in the same kind of ways, I think that, yeah, it is a bit of a dangerous tendency because of our inability, I think, to necessarily accurately track our own social position and our own kind of privilege.
I wonder if we need, that's why we need a word other than pride. Mm-hmm. Scott, stop talking. We don't have time. Yes,
that, I was just about to say, all of this is fodder for the podcast. So let's get there.
Well, you're allowed to say that. Would you like to say that?
All this is fodder for the podcast. Let's just get there.
Okay. Well done. Scott's timed out, everybody. That's it for the radio portion of The Mindfield. Susie Kilmister is lecturer in philosophy at Monash University, our guest for this week's show. So she'll be hanging around for the podcast element, which we're about to get into right now. But the radio portion is at an end, and we'll see you with another one of those next week. Like a rolling
stone. I think we've really strayed into quite possibly the most productive territory that we could be exploring. Can I draw someone like James Baldwin into this? Because I think he's really, really helpful at this point. Baldwin was kind of famously ambivalent about Muhammad Ali in all sorts of ways. Not because he didn't like the displays of countervailing pride, but he thought that they didn't produce the context that they were meant to produce. So he uses this example, and I find the example amazingly helpful. He says, a student cannot be taught by a teacher who holds that student in contempt. So his idea is the purpose of any display of countervailing pride. So I would even say, you know, I am a man. I am someone who is owed recognition by virtue of my belonging to this political community, by virtue, even if we don't want to say by virtue of my being a person, if we want to sort of, you know, cast dignity as a kind of inalienable quality of human being as such. But if we simply say that by virtue of my being in this political community, I am owed a voice, I am owed your recognition. The purpose of that claim is to create the sufficient conditions for there to be something like moral communication between these two parties. And here, I think, is where James Baldwin's diagnosis of what happens when pride, those kind of countervailing assertions of pride, go too far, that they have the effect of lowering the very person to whom you are inviting into something like democratic conversation. What happens when you lower them is they can't hear you because they don't think you have anything to then teach them. And I think here's where Kant's idea of what pride does is it uses the lowering of the other as a means to my self-glorification, as a means to my elevation. It thereby reduces someone to a means to my end, which anybody who knows anything about Kantian philosophy, that is the great sort of philosophical or moral sin within Kant's system, reducing somebody else to a means to my glorification. So I think if we think about these displays of countervailing pride or of self-esteem as creating conditions within which people can meet as equals, then doesn't that, I think, maybe help us see a way beyond or without tipping over into this kind of oppressor-oppressed cycle that you've both been talking about?
I think there's something to that, but I'm just going to play devil's advocate a little bit. People are going to think I'm all in favor of arrogance and displays of superiority. But I do think there's something that's worth drawing attention to, which is who the audience is meant to be for these kinds of displays. Because you put it in terms of it's not very helpful to have these displays of superiority if we're trying to engage in some kind of democratic conversation. But I think sometimes these displays aren't intended for that, and they might have a purpose beyond that, which is to, in a sense, create an environment in which people who are oppressed talk to one another, are communicating to one another about the horrors of their oppressor. And so if the target audience is fellow members of the oppressed group, I think these kinds of displays can be this kind of useful way of bolstering up a collective sense of pride. And part of that has to be, sometimes potentially, a refusal to, in a sense, engage with the oppressor on terms of an equal. That's a kind of maybe potentially dangerous idea, but I think I've thought about this quite a lot in the context of Trump's America, and I was in the States right after the election, and one of the kind of conversations that was happening in all these corridors was, what do we kind of, in a sense, owe those who are now kind of triumphing in this new world order? do we have to engage respectfully? In what sense can we show our kind of horror and maybe even contempt at those who brought us to this position? And a number of people who were occupying, I guess, oppressed positions in the society were really kind of articulating this idea of, if we, in order for us to acknowledge the kind of situation that we're in order for us to be able to acknowledge to one another what's been, in a sense, done to us, it's really important not to just kind of turn and immediately start engaging as democratic equals in this kind of respectful back and forth. That's in some sense to downplay or fail to acknowledge the system of oppression that we're in. So I think this idea of there being at least sometimes occasions on which these displays of dominance or superiority have this different kind of purpose, a kind of in-group building of collective pride and acknowledgement of the inappropriateness of the ways that have been treated in the past, that it might at least sometimes, right, have some productive kind of pathway. Though I acknowledge that, again, we're not very good judges of when we're in those kinds of situations, and so, in a sense, licensing that kind of behaviour can potentially lead it to being used in situations where it's not appropriate.
I just wonder how easy it is to flick the switch. So, like, at what point do you say, well, no, this is just for internal consumption, it's like it serves a particular civic function within, but once we're engaging externally, then that's not appropriate. Yeah? Or do you inculcate a particular ethos? And then that just becomes who you are, and you start to express that. I mean, we've spoken about Muhammad Ali, but I actually think a person that we might have been better to think about might have been a Malcolm X, because he undergoes this transformation where clearly he understands why he went through the whole Nation of Islam thing and all that, but he comes out the other side. And he starts to try to say, no, I've got to see white people as my brothers, and I've got to, you know, work with them and this sort of thing. I think he understands himself. He forgives himself for what he's done in the past, but he doesn't think that's the right way to go about it, because he ends up adopting a different sort of a model. Now, people might like or not like the model he ends up adopting, but the fact that he's gone through that transformation is the thing that's interesting about it. Right?
But I wonder how much getting to the end point requires having gone through that transformation, right? That it is in fact a process. And we might say that we really shouldn't see these kinds of displays of dominance or whatever it is as a good end point. But in terms of being able to get to a position where people have been oppressed, are able to take that kind of higher ground, see their oppressors as equals, might require a kind of bolstering that... that looks a lot like...
So they have to talk about them as lesser for until they understand, until they believe that they're equal. Like, they're talking themselves into equality by talking about the other people.
It might depend what we mean by talking about the others as lesser, I suppose. If we're talking about kind of basic moral worth, I would be very nervous about...
That's often the expression it takes, right?
Yeah, but sometimes I think it can take a kind of... moral evaluation, right? Those people are worse than us because look at the kind of things that they do. And that kind of thing, I think, might have more of a place of we're better than them because we don't do those kinds of things, because that might help you get a grip on when to kind of stop, right? Or see when you might be turning into the very thing that you're being contemptuous of, right? So if the contempt target is certain kinds of behavior, certain kind of practices, rather than certain human beings, right, then that might give you some kind of traction, I suppose.
So this plays out, like, as we speak, it plays out. Like, this is one of the several tensions that seems to exist between the old warriors of the civil rights movement. I know we're always talking about African-American politics for some reason. I don't know why we fixated on this. But anyway, the divide between veterans of the civil rights movement and the engine of the Black Lives Matter movement, right? This idea that, you know, that these civil rights veterans, they say, well, we were anchored in the church, we believed white people were our brothers and sisters, and we addressed them as such, even as we took very steely action against them, were prepared to sacrifice a lot. That was an important kind of civic bond. Now, I don't know what conversations were happening internally within the civil rights, whether they spoke that way internally or that was just for public consumption. But you see the philosophical divide here. And I suppose what I'm asking is, in your scheme, do you think that it's impossible to adopt this thing where you are very much on guard about the excesses of pride or some version of pride that will in the long run become oppressive, while still making all of the necessary claims that need to be made? Or is this something that you see as a necessary
approach?
I think some element of this, it can maybe we might think of as elevated pride, I think is necessary. What kinds of expressions it ought to take, I think, is a much more difficult kind of question. But I'm thinking about something like queer pride, not just as we are also human and we are equal, though I think that that's an element of it, but a real sense of like there's a culture here, there's a community, there's a way of being that, members of that community might express as being better than. And I guess that's part of what I'm saying is I don't necessarily think that's a problem, that we can take pride in this thing that we do that we think is really good and valuable and worthy, and you know, those kind of boring people don't do it. That kind of thing I think doesn't need to be pernicious. But that's very different from expressions of moral superiority in the sense of we think we have a kind of deeper moral worth, or that non-queer people are contemptuous or something like that. But that kind of community building, which I think can take the form not just of we two are equals, but there are elements of what we do and the way we are that are better, that strikes me as potentially being valuable and a valuable tool to counter the kind of message that so many people get that they're inferior, of finding those things to take pride in the way we are, to get to that point of then being able to kind of express this kind of fellowship and community and equality with those people who have previously been oppressors.
Susie, I think this is an incredibly important point that you've touched on. To some extent, it actually undercuts your argument and hands it a bit more cleanly to Waleed, because in some ways, part of the criticism is that there is a form of dominant culture that is as such because of its historical record and because of the proceeds of that historical record is morally bankrupt. I mean, I'm not putting too fine a point on it to say that that is very much the critique that is leveled at, say, white, hetero, dominant Western culture. That this is something that is now reaping the benefits of massively ill-gotten gains over an astonishingly brutal period of time. And so that there is a kind of cultural evaluation that's happening there. So if we understand pride as being something that is relative to others, but it's also pegged against something like common value, something like an understanding of what is appropriate for a political or for a moral community, the values that are appropriate to them, then by denying the other side moral legitimacy as such because of the moral legacy of the dominant culture to which they are a part, I mean, there is a kind of zero-sum claim in that that is potentially problematic because it breaks down, I think, it reduces to nothing the very possibility for there to be communication between these two moral universes. But then you think about someone like James Baldwin. I'm sorry for coming back to him, but you know, he went through a period of intense contemptuousness of the order of someone like Elijah Muhammad, for instance, for white people. But then he arrived at the point where his fundamental claim wasn't that the moral universe in which that you inhabit, white people, is bankrupt. It's rotten to its very core. Instead, he said, if we can agree on a fundamental point, you white brothers have been killing your brothers who are black, and you know full well that they are your brothers, and that is your crime. There's something about that moving from contempt or moving from that overweening pride to creating the fundamental basis upon which we can recognize one another, creating those necessary points of moral connection where these two universes overlap instead of insisting on the zero-sum game. That, I think, I mean, how pride serves that or undercuts it, that's a very, very delicate question. But sometimes you do need to first accentuate the contrast and then desperately find that one point where you can say, surely we can stand in moral judgment over one another on this point of all points.
Yeah, so I think what's really crucial there is this idea that whatever form our pride takes, it shouldn't take the form of seeing other people as in some sense outside the moral universe, as somehow kind of in something beyond contempt or beneath contempt, right? That kind of move I think is incredibly dangerous. But I do think that there is a kind of space for a kind of pride that doesn't get to that point, right, of saying that the things that, that your community has done really are contemptuous, but you, person within that community, are still a moral being who I'm going to hold, in a sense, to moral account. And there's, in a sense, an attempt at a request for redemption here, right? Of a, you will be again my equal in an evaluative sense if you stop doing these things, or collectively if you all stop doing these things. So it's not a kind of once and for all, we're better than you, but just a notice that what you've done is wrong in the scheme of things. And so you have to, in a sense, earn your place back in this evaluative kind of schema. That's a very different kind of move, I think, from the, you know, kind of trying to isolate the community off and saying we're better than everybody else and those people are beneath contempt and we don't have to worry about them. I agree that's a potentially very dangerous kind of path to go down.
But a really attractive one.
It can really be attractive, I think, true. As well. And I think, you know, I want to recognise my own position as a, you know, cis white woman who middle class as well. I don't really know what it's like to be at the receiving end of bad forms of oppression. And I think asking people in those communities, people who are vulnerable and have been subject to abuses of power, asking them to kind of, as a first step, notice, you know, to treat and talk to their oppressors as equals might just be asking too much, right? And so I think a kind of acknowledgement of, even if we don't think it's an ideal endpoint, an acknowledgement that this community building, self-worth building, collective worth building process might look ugly at times, but it might also be necessary and something that we need to kind of create space for, while keeping an eye on the fact that it could potentially take these kind of turns in the long run.
We're out of time, but can I just clarify one thing? Because I spoke about the Malcolm X example as though Muhammad Ali hadn't been through a similar transition in his own right, which of course he has, and I'm aware of that. I was kind of trying to talk about the concept rather than get into the biographies of everybody, but
I thought that was beautifully deftly done, Willie. That was fine.
Thank you. But yeah, I just wanted to get in before you get letters, because I won't see them, so it doesn't matter. Right. Jeez, I've talked myself into a hole here. Either way, we are out of time. Susie, your expertise has been invaluable, so thank you very much for helping
us. Thanks for having me.
You've been listening to an ABC podcast. Discover more great ABC podcasts, live radio, and exclusives on the ABC Listen app.